Melissa Clark is known to readers of the New York Times for her columns in the Wednesday food section called A Good Appetite. She was on our show in October to discuss her 29th book, this one called In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, 150 Recipes and Stories About the Food You Love. It's part memoir, part cookbook, with stories of how the dishes came into being, about cooking for and with her family, and about the sources of her inspiration, including other people's recipes that she's refashioned. Publishers Weekly called the book an engaging and scrumptious collection, and we thought that we would rebroadcast that conversation today as many of us are preparing a Thanksgiving dinner for friends and loved ones. I started by asking Melissa Clark, aren't you a bit young to have written 29 books? Are you the Joyce Carol Oates of the culinary world?
Oh, I like that. Oh, I'll take that as a big compliment. You know, I always say a girl's got to make a living, and I'm usually working on more than one book at the same time.
And you've also written books that aren't about food. A novel?
No, that is another Melissa Clark, and she and I email all the time.
Oh, gee, I wondered about that. I figured in the 29, that had to be at least one work of fiction.
Oh, God, there's plenty of works of fiction, but they're all actually in my cookbooks.
And then you became a mother 2 years ago.
I assume that slowed you down a little bit. You know what? That has slowed me down, but in the most wonderful way. And it's expanded my horizons. It's made me a very different cook.
Well, when you got your MFA in writing in graduate school, mm-hmm. What did you think you'd be doing professionally?
I did think I'd write a novel. So when you say that, I sort of have this little twinge of, oh, but wait, I will one day. Really, I will. I have the unfinished one under my bed.
And how did you become a food writer?
You know, I loved writing and I loved food, and those were my two passions. And when we were in grad school at Columbia, we had a wonderful advisor, a man by the name of Richard Locke, and he sat all of us down, the whole program, and he said, okay, I just want you to know that you're all going to have to make a living when you leave here, so why don't you start thinking about that? And being a novelist is a very hard route. So he taught us that we should specialize in something, and I thought, oh, well, food is my passion. And I was already catering at that point. I had a little catering company up at Columbia University, and I did all the graduation ceremonies. I did all the, you know, thesis parties, and pretty much the professors had a choice. It was the deli down the street or me, and I was cheaper, so...
You also had the example of some pretty great food writers like M.F.K. Fisher.
Yes, and I always...
Who made writing about food something other than just writing about food.
She was my mentor who I never met. I read all of her books, you know, at a young age when I was in college, and I discovered her. And so I always knew that food would be a big theme in my writing. Even if I had become a novelist and not a food writer, food would be a character constantly.
And there are a number of writers like the Efron sisters who include recipes in their novels.
Yes, and they are fantastic. And I just bow at their feet and wish I could write like them.
But was M.F.K. Fisher one of the inspirations for this book, which is more than just a collection of recipes?
Yeah, she's always on my shoulder when I write, which is good and bad, because on the one hand, I have her there and she is an inspiration. And I think, well, you know, she did this. And on the other hand, I think, can I do this as well as she could? And it makes me a better editor because I'm rewriting a lot to try to, you know, meet a very high standard.
Your dedication reads, to my parents who taught me firsthand just how deeply food means love.
Yes.
Well, a lot of the people I've spoken to who are in the food world grew up in families where food was not valued, and they almost discovered good food as a form of self-defense.
That's how my parents did, exactly. They, both of them grew up in households where food was not important at all. It was all about education. It was all about studying. You know, you ate to fuel your education. And in our family, it was a very voluptuous upbringing. Food was the center of our relationship. The table was where we talked about things. It brought us together. And that's very essential to me and my family, too.
And your family spent summers in France visiting the restaurants and the Michelin Guide.
Yes, that was my dad's.
They must have had a couple of bucks anyway.
You know, back then when I remember it was in the 80s or 70s when the franc was 10 to the dollar, and we felt like so rich. You know, compared to living in Brooklyn, we would exchange our house. So we'd have French people come and stay in our Brooklyn house, and we'd go stay in some house in France, and we just would spend everything on food.
And now the euro,
forget about it.
Just keeps on going up.
Yeah. But I had an extraordinarily, you know, just charmed childhood in this way. And I got to eat all these different foods that I don't think you couldn't do it today. You just couldn't.
including things that you didn't know you were eating. You say yeah. your parents lied to you about certain ingredients, telling you that rabbit was chicken.
Yeah, my mother was crafty about that. And, you know, as a mother, when I was a kid, I was so outraged. I was like, what do you mean this is rabbit? You know, the way I discovered that is I was a kid and my mother served me chicken for dinner. And then she had a dinner party and I was eavesdropping on the phone. Remember when everyone had landlines and you were a kid, you could pick up the receiver and eavesdrop. And a guest called his son and told the son that they'd had rabbit. And I thought, wait, I ate out of that pot. That was chicken, wasn't it? And it was that moment of feeling so deceived. But now that I'm a mother, I completely understand it. I lie to my child all the time about what she's eating.
But what was the process? So you discovered that you ate rabbit. Did that mean that you never wanted to trust your mother again, or you were willing to eat rabbit the next time?
No,
it came
I never
up?
Trusted her again. Actually, that was the end of it. That was every time she. What do you mean? Are you sure? What is that? Really? But that was the end of a long trail of deception. She had told us that steak. You know, she had served steak, and it was horse steak. She had served.
She wanted to try everything.
She wanted to try everything, and she just wanted us to play along. And eventually we did. And there is a story in the book, because all of these stories, by the way, that I'm telling are in the book right now. And where I ate sweetbreads for the first time, and my mother was so happy that she could tell me this was a deep fried sweetbread and not a chicken nugget. Mm. And it was sort of this family moment of, hey, we're all on the same page.
Although sweetbreads, that name alone is a bit of a deception.
That's very true, because it's the thymus gland.
if they said
in case
you're
you
going to have thymus.
Exactly.
On
no
a
one
menu.
Would eat that. No one would eat a thymus gland, really.
You said your mother was unwilling to follow a recipe exactly. Are you the same way? Because you do give exact measurements in your recipes.
You know, I don't expect – I give them because that's what's demanded of me as a cookbook writer, but I don't expect anyone to follow them. In fact, please don't follow any of my recipes. You know, just go have a good time in the kitchen. That's what I do.
Well, in the old days, cookbooks weren't that specific. Nobody wrote one tablespoon plus
– Exactly, a half a teaspoon of, you know, turmeric. Yeah.
Right. It simply said to taste or right. the right amount.
Right. And, you know,
what happened?
I think what happened is the science of home economics developed. This is what I think. And that just led to food preparation becoming a science rather than an art. And we in America really embrace this science. And we kind of converted the way we thought about it. Instead of, you know, I love the idea of a knob of butter and a pinch of this and a pinch of that. And when I tell people on the phone how to make something, because everyone calls me up and says, what do I do? I always say a pinch, a knob, a dash. And it's just, first of all, it feels better to say it. And also, people should cook by feel. People should really, you know, how much do you like salt or pepper or cumin or coriander? If you like it a lot, make your pinch big. If you don't, make it small. You know, really tailor the recipe to what you want to eat.
Of course, that's not when you're baking.
You can even do it when you're baking if you know the rules. There are certain There's a skeleton to every baking recipe, and you really do need to be an experienced baker, but home baker, to know what the skeleton is. Like, there are certain proportions you can't muck with. You cannot change the baking soda, the baking powder, but you can change the butter. You can change the spices. If you don't like cinnamon, you can add ginger. The fruit is very much interchangeable. So there's a lot of ways that you can personalize baking.
You just can't put more liquid in or,
right.
or
yeah.
more flour
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Unless you really know what you're doing.
Were you doing a lot of cooking when you were growing up? Because there are some people, some mothers, who do not allow their kids in the kitchen.
Oh, no. I cooked constantly. I was a dessert maker in the house because my parents, as much as they loved food, they didn't have a lot of dessert in the house. So if I wanted dessert, I had to make it. So from a very young age, I learned how to make cookies and cakes, and I was making them constantly because, well, first of all, I wanted to eat them. And second of all, I discovered that having a baked good in your school bag is a very good way to smooth social interactions, you know? I mean, anyone will save a seat for you in the lunchroom if they know you're going to come packing cheesecake. So that was very good for my social status.
My guest is Melissa Clark, who writes A Good Appetite for the New York Times dining section, and now has written a book called In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, 150 recipes and stories about the food you love, published by Hyperion. Sarah Moulton was here recently, and she said that most people stick to about 10 recipes.
That, I think, is true. And I wish that people would be more adventuresome when they're cooking. But, you know, it's hard because when you have a family, you don't have a lot of time. You're nervous when you're making something new. So you want to stick to the tried and true, which is why I think you have to take those 10 recipes that are your repertory, they're the foods you know how to make, and play with them and improvise and make them a little different every time you make them. Because, I mean, I pretty much make the same 10 recipes too, but I flavor them differently. You know, I always roast my cauliflower, but sometimes I roast it with pomegranate molasses, or sometimes I roast it with buttered almonds, or sometimes I roast it with bacon. And each time, it's the same dish. It's just slightly different. I always call it, I change the outfit. But it's the same, the same dish.
Well, some people want to try new things when they have guests over, and others are afraid to do anything new because there is always a chance you're going to have a disaster.
Yeah, I've had a lot of disasters, and I've learned something really important. When you have a disaster, change the name of the dish. I've made wonderful bitter eggplant salad. I've made it's supposed to be al dente pasta, really. You just kind of pretend that that's what it should be. And most of the time, if you give your guests enough wine, you will get away with it.
You use ingredients from various cultures, lemongrass, cilantro, jalapenos, garlic. Well, garlic, of course, is now our culture. Is this American cooking, or is this the way cooking is going in the world? Because in France, we're seeing a lot of fusion cooking as well.
I think this is the way the cooking is going. I think it's
Italy. I just was in Italy. It's still pasta.
It's still very traditional there. I think it depends. It's very American. My book is completely American. I grew up in Brooklyn. My cooking is all about this country, and we are all about grabbing different spices and flavors from all across the world. And I do that. But in the book, what I want to make sure to do is all of the recipes they're adventuresome in that I'm using different flavors, but they're accessible. You can get everything in the supermarket. And luckily today, you can really get most things you need in the supermarket.
You even include a recipe for egg cream, which I think is more than – it's really New York, not American. I'm not sure that people even know what an egg cream is in Omaha.
No, most people think an egg cream is a drink that has eggs and cream in it, which is natural. But it's a seltzer-based drink that has a little bit of milk and a lot of chocolate syrup. And it is so delicious. And if you've never had one, please go and make one immediately.
Does this require a recipe?
I don't think it does. But I put one in the book because for people who think that it's egg and cream, just to make sure. But just make chocolate milk with a lot of chocolate and a lot of seltzer. And you'll love it. It's frothy and cold and sweet.
You have certain things you have negative feelings about. You abhor almond extract. Why?
I've even come around to it a little bit. I've been doing some recipe testing for other people. But I did. At one point, I really hated almond extract. I felt it tasted like artificial. It just tasted like almond extract. It didn't taste like almonds to me. And I know that it's derived from the flavor of bitter almonds, which is a different flavor profile than regular almonds. But that's not in – I'm not used to that. So when I want almonds, I want softness and nuttiness. I don't want sort of a sharp, high, tinge that a sort of zingy flavor that you get from the almond extract.
So you prefer vanilla?
I'm a vanilla girl. But really, I like chocolate.
Do you feel that way about truffle oil and other cheat ingredients?
Truffle oil, back when truffle oil first came on the market and it was really made from truffles, I loved it. Oh, I just loved it. But now it doesn't even smell like truffles. It just sort of smells like, I don't know what it smells
like.
What do you think it smells like? Yeah, it smells like truffle oil, and I'd rather not.
You also tested a lot of pie crust recipes. There are people who will argue long into the night as to whether you should use butter or Crisco or lard. What do you think?
I am a butter and lard girl, personally.
But a lot of people resist lard.
Yeah, they do. And I can understand why. There's a lot of really bad lard on the market. In fact, most lard that you get in the supermarket has been hydrogenated. So it's really unhealthy. It's as bad as Crisco. It's, as bad as any of those solid vegetable shortenings. However, if you can get good lard from a butcher, it's not as terrible for you. And it really does make the crust flakier and adds a slightly savory edge to it. But all butter is great. You don't need anything else but butter for a pie crust. Just make sure your ingredients are cold and you will get a nice flake.
You've talked about this any number of times with me, and you mentioned it in your book. Your husband is lactose intolerant, and here you are saying cheesecake.
he would take issue with that. He always says, I'm very tolerant of lactose. I just choose not to eat it. But he does, he does have a reaction to lactose, except for butter, luckily. And that was hard on us at the beginning. And when I first met him, I really thought, can I marry a man who I can't – if we have a pint of ice cream in the freezer, I'm really going to have to take responsibility for eating the whole thing because I know it's not going to be ham. And that was daunting. But
so what do you do?
I got over it.
You cook around it?
I cook around it. And I've really learned to order all the cheesy, creamy things that I want to eat. I order them in restaurants. I go into a restaurant. I look at the menu. And whatever has the most cheese on it is the thing that I order. And at home, I cook a lot. My cooking is very much geared toward vegetables. It's a little bit fresher and lighter than it was. But I still use a lot of butter because for some reason he can eat butter. Thank God.
But you remain thin.
I work out and where I work it.
That's a definite trick. You have a blog as well. Does it keep you close touch with your readers?
Because
in the old days you would write the column, right. And I'm sure you got some mail, but it's not the same thing, is it?
You know, I love when people comment, but I don't get a lot of comments. So please come to my blog, melissaclark.net, and I want to hear from you because I love the interaction. I love when people tell me, you know what I love? I love when someone says, oh, I made your recipe, but I didn't actually make your recipe. You said to do this, and I did something completely different, and it was delicious. I love hearing that because that's what I do, and I think that that's the most fun way to cook in the kitchen.
You have recipe testers? You just can't trust yourself to do the recipe?
I do. I always have a recipe tester to clean up my act behind me because I worked fast.
We have included several of the recipes on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, by the author of the Good Appetite column in the New York Times dining section, Melissa Clark, 150 Recipes and Stories About the Food You Love. It's published by Hyperion. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.